Hey guys, real quick before we jump into this next episode, I want to discuss something with you. I made a decision a couple of years ago not to bombard this podcast with tons of ads or just bombard you with sponsorship. Nothing would drive me more crazy when listening to other podcasts when the first 5 minutes were nothing but ads. So I worked hard not to do that to you. I try to keep the ads to a minimum and keep the podcast as streamlined as possible. So do me a favor. Go check out Phoenix Shooting Bags. Buy yourself a bag. Up your shooting game. You're going to thank me. And if you're not a rifle hunter, go buy yourself a glassing pad. Your butt is going to thank me after spending hours behind the glass. They're awesome. If you use promo code John Stallone, all one word, you'll save 20%. And lastly, please, I know you heard me say it, iTunes, Podbean, go leave us a review. I need the feedback. The ratings help me reach more people, and it helps me keep this free. So do me a favor, check out Phoenix Shooting Bags, and go leave us a review. Thank you. Let's roll into this next episode.
All right, so we're back on with Nathan Brooks, and if you didn't catch the last episode or part one of this episode, we've been talking about tuning bows and so on and so forth, and we were just kind of getting into, you know, how the industry hasn't really changed a whole bunch, and there's a lot of gadgets that come back and forth and so on and so forth. So that actually kind of leads me into my first question for you for the part two. You know, not everybody has unlimited funds, you know, and without giving specific brands or whatever, but what do you feel like is more important? Should the bulk of your investment be in the actual bow, or should it be in the components, or like you mentioned, arrows in the last part one, is that, you know, arrows are so important, you get what you pay for. What do you think is more important? Like, if you had, I don't know, I don't even want to give a dollar amount, but let's say $1,000 total. I don't know, that's not even too much. Yeah, let's just say $1,000 total. What would you put, you know, 60% towards the bow, or I don't know. I don't even know how to quantify that, but hopefully you understand where I'm kind of getting at with that.
I do, yeah. It's a question that actually gets asked quite a bit, or at least that I hear quite often. And I guess that really would depend on where you're at as a shooter. You know, when I was talking about you get what you get for arrows, if I was just starting, that super high quality arrow is not as important as it is to someone that has been shooting a long time and kind of has their form dialed in and all that sort of stuff. So I would definitely want decent arrows. I wouldn't want the cheapest thing that's on the market. I can promise you that. But I would spend a decent amount. I'd go probably medium grade as far as arrows goes. If I'm looking at, you know, value being, you know, from high to low, I'd go with the right there in the middle basically for arrows. Broadheads honestly would probably be where I would spend less. I know that kind of seems it might seem funny to most hunters, but there's some really good quality broadheads, mechanical, that aren't a whole lot of, you know, that don't cost a whole lot, and shot placement's more important than what you, in my opinion, more important than what you're sticking through the animal is where you stick through the animal. You kill them with a field point if that's really, you know, you make the right shot. I wouldn't suggest it because you can't hardly find them, but they definitely would kill them. So, but I would say I would spend more on probably a good quality sight. Because it can be such a pain. And don't get me wrong, there are good low. It's really a big question. It really is, because there's good quality stuff at value prices. There really is. But you have to be selective in what you're buying. And what I mean by that is, number one, I wouldn't buy anything plastic because, you know, there's a lot of sites on the market that you see out there that have a lot of plastic components to it. And whereas it might look really slick and be super lightweight and all that sort of stuff, you're adjusting that quite a bit, and it gets beat up quite a bit, and it's really important. So I would definitely go for a high-quality site. I think the bow is a really important key factor here, but again, we're also trying to evaluate that in terms of,
I know it's such a hard
of where the archer's at. You know, I mean, if I was a really great archer, I could get by with a lot less bow. I mean, I don't know if that makes sense or not, but I mean, I could use a lesser bow if I was a really great archer than a beginning archer. Oftentimes I see that is a beginning archer goes and buys the cheapest bow. Well, it's just not very well made. And so they struggle right from the very beginning. It doesn't fit right. It doesn't have consistent feel every time when you draw the bow back. If I've seen it one time, I've seen it 1,000 where somebody shoots a bow for their first time and they hit their arm and, you know, put this big strawberry on their arm from one end to the other, basically, and they don't even want to shoot anymore. And they're totally jaded about archery from the get-go, you know. So I would spend a decent amount of that money towards a good bow, something that would tune really well, because I think that's really important for a beginner. Again, if you're a really seasoned shooter, you can get by with less because you know what to do and you should know how to tune. Even inexpensive bows will tune. You may have to, you know, revert to some old school tactics to make it work, but it will tune. So, I don't know if I really answered that question good, but it's really broad. So
it is. But I, you know what though, it's you kind of, because I've heard people say a bunch of times, oh well, you know, don't put him in $1,000 bow or whatever because he's never going to be able to outshoot that bow. Basically, you know, that
right.
It performs better than he can perform. Or you know, don't put her in that because, you know, she's not shooting past 40 yards or 50 yards anyway because of her draw length and her poundage or whatever. And I found that, and I found this out with my wife, the first bow I bought her was basically one of those kind of like youth bows that were adjustable, you know, from, I don't know, like 20 inches
to 30 inches. Yeah, like, got that huge range. Yeah,
something crazy like that, and it's and it goes from like 30 pounds to 60 pounds or, you know, 70 pounds, whatever. And she just did not shoot it well. And then like I put her in a Matthews Jewel, and she started shooting really well. Like she looked like she had been shooting for a long time, and I started. I mean, that's what like woke me up, and I was like, you know what? There's something to this. Like, I mean, I knew it from optics, I knew it from other stuff, and I learned it the hard way myself. And I told people, I was like, I bought Bushnells, and then I bought Nikons, then I bought Fujinons, then I bought, you know, this and that, and then I end up going with the best anyway. I end up going with what I feel is the best, which is Swarovski. But and it's like, I feel like, if you don't have the money to buy top-end stuff, don't go buy shitty shit just to get you through. You know, stick with whatever you got for now. I mean, if you're a first-time buyer, maybe it's a little different scenario, but and then just save up until you can afford the better stuff. Because the better stuff, really, it's better and it costs more money because it's better, right. You know? And it does perform. Like, you know, you're talking about sights. A very well precision machine sight is going to have micro adjustments. Where one that you're having, you know, I know back in the day when we were like eyeball stuff, sliding pins, and like, oh, I think I got it that, you know, tenth of an inch or hundredth of an inch or whatever I was trying to move it. You know, oh, now I'm hitting 2 inches to the right. Oh, can move it. Now I'm hitting 1 inch to the left. And you just can never find a sweet spot. And that stuff can, you know, it computes to the money that you spend. And I don't know. We get this question often. That's why I kind of wanted to ask you of it. But it's so broad. It's so hard to answer. And everybody's situation is different. But I say save up and buy this stuff, the better stuff, when you can afford it.
I answer that question a lot for young kids that are just starting, and, you know, parents come to me, hey, what bow should I get her? You know, I want to get her into archery, and like, you know, what should I expect? And they, well, I mean, are you really wanting to get her into archery, or are you wanting her to try archery? Because if she wants to try it, there's a totally different thing. And if she wants to get into it, then I would say, let's get into it. You know, let's, like you said, make sure that you are not just buying the cheapest stuff that you can get to get by, because their experience, their ability to hit the middle is going to make all the difference in the world and whether they stay in archery or not. And I see that so often. I mean, I don't know of anyone that is an excellent shooter, that's really, really good shooter, that was taking their game to the next level and to the next level and the next level, that got out of archery because they were still hitting the middle. They got out because they started sucking it up.
Right.
And they weren't having the success that they were hoping to have. And so then they leave. And I see that with kids a lot.
Yep.
If you can start a kid off and put a big balloon up for them and let them shoot and pop that balloon, hey, there's instant gratification. They love it. They enjoy that. They accomplish something, you know. And the more they put arrows in the middle, the more likely they are to stay shooting that bow and continue to do it over and over and over again. And so that being said, especially, and I think this is especially true in the low end market, because the low end is what you would call that beginner market. A lot of times, that the stuff is made so broad and so adaptable that it's not customizable enough to reach that high level of performance. And I mean, don't get me wrong, there are some bows out there that have a lot more adjustment than others, and they fit well. But when you get into that really low side of things where the kids are starting and that sort of stuff, man, you can really get into some high level junk.
Yep.
Because it just doesn't have the repeatable feel or a back wall. I had I coaching a young kid and he's got tons of talent and has a little bow that he brought up here, and we tried to fashion some sort of draw stop or some sort of good limb stop, something where it was repeatable enough for him, because he would hit the valley and then he would just keep cranking. He basically would pull the bow back as far as he could pull it. I'm like, hey buddy, you know, relax a little bit, let's just try and draw it here. And so, you know, eventually I painted a mark across the cables when it was at full draw and said, hey, line these two marks up. You know, so he'd draw his bow back and he'd just basically work it around till those cables got lined up and that mark across there was equal. So he could see that's where he's drawing to, and he needs to draw that way every time. If he draws past, it goes, you know, those cable marks don't line up. So, but the bow just has such a big valley on the back end, it's hard for him to be accurate with it. So, you know, that higher quality bow doesn't feel like that. That more expensive bow, it doesn't feel like that. They have good back walls. They have good, solid let off that, you know, you can hold and be comfortable and that sort of thing. So,
yeah, agreed. Let's talk a little bit about shooting extreme angles. What are some of the things to consider about shooting extreme angles?
The number one thing to consider is you better practice it, because if you don't. If you don't practice and you think that the rangefinder just magically reads the right number, even though it has the angle calculator and all that sort of stuff in it, you would be very mistaken if you just go by that. The further distance you get out, the steeper that angle gets, the further off that gets. And everyone is different in their peep side height and their draw length and their length from their peep sight to their sight. All that changes everything when you're talking about long range shooting at extreme angles or even just extreme angles in general. We shoot a tournament. There's a tournament every year in Pennsylvania. It's called the OPA. Levi Morgan started this tournament several years ago. And it's touted basically as one of the toughest tournaments, toughest 3D tournaments here in the States, because it's held on a ski resort and you have to adjust for those angles and that sort of stuff. But the level of competition there is just through the roof. I mean, these guys that shoot this stuff, they really know what they're doing. And we have a target there that, I mean, it changes every year, but we had one there a few years ago. It's only a 12-yard target, but it was amazing to me how many people missed it. Not completely missed the whole target, but would miss the 12 or a 14 where they're risking a lot because they didn't know how to shoot that shot. It's a mark, if you're using a slider, it's a mark that you don't have on your slider. It's way, 32-degree angle, 12-yard shot. It's way above that 20-yard mark that you got, which you think might be the closest thing you're shooting. So, or at least it is for me. It might be a little bit different for everyone else, but that's the thing. You have to practice that stuff in order to figure it out. And, you know, when I get out beyond 10-degree angle, my rangefinder is not right anymore. I have to take off more yardage than what my rangefinder says to take off if I'm going to hit it. So, and that will change at different speeds too. So I think the slower you shoot, probably the more accurate that is. So the faster you shoot, obviously you got to figure those things out. So, I got a good friend of mine, one of the best in the world at shooting angles, Tim Gillingham. And, that guy, I mean, he's got so much data from his bows that he's kept over the years, and he always tries to shoot around 300 feet per second because, you know, if you go changing that speed a lot, that data is not the same anymore. It doesn't help you. So, I mean, it may help you, but it's not exact or precise. And so you have to
about his cut sheets and all the stuff that he does. Yeah, he's a mad scientist with that shit.
Absolutely, he's intense, but that's what makes him so good. I mean, you'll not meet a person that has spent more hours behind a bow trying to dissect something from top to bottom than what you'll find in Tim Gillingham.
Sure. what are some other bow tuning items that we should think about when it comes to shooting angles? I know there's third access and stuff like that, but is there anything?
I think arrow rest makes a lot of difference in what you're shooting. Whether you're shooting an arrow rest that is a drop away or a spring type arrow rest, something that has a rebound to it.
Okay.
Because when you are aiming down and the gravity of, you know, gravity's pulling down on the arrow or whatnot, if you're shooting a blade type arrow rest or something with a spring to it, it doesn't quite compute the same.
Okay.
Because the weight is not, you know, you don't have as much weight on that arrow rest anymore. So it reacts a little different. And as I said, there's no substitute for practice and training and experience in that situation, just doing it over and over and over and learning your equipment. So without just saying, oh, here's what you should expect, what I can tell you that you're going to expect at extreme angles is the unexpected, because if you haven't done it, you need to go do it to make sure you understand what you're getting into.
Oh yeah, for sure. Every year they have here at Snow Bowl, or not Snow Bowl, at Sunrise. We have a tournament. Not really. It's not really. I mean, you could do a tournament, but it's there's a fun shoot and there's an extreme course, and the extreme course is all super long shots and super, you know, steep angles and stuff like that. And it's great because it's always in July, so it's always right before hunting season starts. I'd love to go do that, but it's definitely one of those courses that, yeah, I mean, you may not, but I lose an arrow, you know, at least one on that course every year, you know, where it's like I completely missed the target or bounces off the back and it goes, or hit a break. They make all these like super tight like shooting windows, like trying to shoot through trees and stuff. It's pretty crazy, but yeah, no, definitely to practice that stuff. Last thing I want to talk about on shooting angles is body position. We talked about form a lot in part one, but when you're shooting, everybody, you know, you always hear bend at the waist, and so on and so forth. But I mean, not that
hard to do.
I don't have very much, you know, much lateral movement, you know, side to side. So what are some of the things that you can address, or what are some of the things you could suggest on shooting angles and body position?
Well, the reasoning for someone saying bend at the waist is obviously if you keep your upper body all the same, you know, then the anchor should feel the same and everything else should feel the same. Well, even if you bend at the waist, you're still changing that a little bit, how that feels. So it depends on the distance and in the shot, but I experimented several years ago with drawing my bow back and just turning my head completely sideways where it didn't feel anything close to the way the anchor is supposed to feel. And getting my eyeball basically right up against the peep sight, just a totally crazy, stupid, awkward feel. And out to about 40 yards, it really didn't make much difference. I hit really close to the same. If I was, you know, in hunting situations, they'd definitely been kill shots, you know, providing the animal doesn't move and that sort of thing. But I mean, I could have hit relatively close to exactly, you know, where I was trying to aim. So I think you can get by with a lot more than what you might think as far as that bending at the waist and just turning your head and things getting out of alignment, so to speak. But it does boil back down to you do have to execute well in that release and how the bow shoots, all that sort of stuff. It's got to be the same as it is the way you try and make it feel in practice. And it's, like I said, you can't really make it feel the same because you're totally out of form from what you're used to. But if you can make the execution part feel the same, for me, I shoot a hinge with basically everything I do. That's just, you know, when I tournament shoot with that. And so I hunt with it because it's so natural for me. If I make my shot, and I just squeeze through the whole thing, the whole entire way, it feels, you know, when the bow fires, it feels the same. It's a surprise sort of shot. And if it always feels that way, it typically goes in the spot where I'm looking. So I don't have to have that anchor exact. But, you know, obviously the closer you can make it to exact, the better off you are. So I don't think you have to bend at the waist to make it right, but it definitely helps with just consistency in that feel of being comfortable.
Right. I did a lot of practicing, especially back in 2015 when I drew my first Ibex tag, because I knew I was going to be faced with like super extreme angles. I had some shots, I mean, just to give you an instance, for instance, where the line of sight was 96 yards and the holdover was like 25. Like, wow. You know, basically straight downhill. And, you know, so I did a lot of shooting where I would just drop my arm and shoot and not really bend at the waist to see if what changes it would make. And like you said, it wasn't severely off, you know, a couple inches here, a couple inches there. What I did notice, and it's not the greatest sight in the whole world. It's, you know, it's got a lot of drawbacks. I shoot the Bow IQ sight, and it's, you know, there's components about it that I love. I do love the retina lock. When it's set up and it's working and it's not moving, because that's been a problem before too, where it's moved. When I get in those crazy extreme angles, as long as I line that retina lock up, I know the bow is going to shoot the same way. So even though I don't feel the same anchor points that I normally would feel, I've been able to consistently, you know, produce. But like I said, it has drawbacks. Like, for instance, in Nevada this year, and I didn't find out till after the fact, I made a shot and I was hitting. And luckily, I figured it out before I shot on it at the animal. But I made a couple of shots to practice on a target, and at 75 yards, I was missing the bag by like 2 inches. You know, it was just a block, regular block target, 16 by 16 inch small block target. And I was missing, so I was missing basically 10 inches, you know, to the right. And I was like, what the, you know, that's crazy. Well, I don't understand what's going on. And it's because the retina lock had moved. And luckily I had figured it out. So that's, you know, that was a drawback. But it's like, I wish they would come up with something that, a system like that, that didn't have those drawbacks, because when I'm faced with extreme angles and you know, when I'm in a situation where I'm just manhandling the hell out of the bow because there's a giant bull in front of me or whatever, you know, it saved me. It saved me many times. But anyway,
yeah. Well, you know, I mean, with that retina lock, I personally don't use it, but I like what it does. I mean, all you're trying to do is duplicate torque load, you know, and however you do that as a shooter, I mean, that's what it's there to do, is show you exactly where you're at every time with your torque load. Because, I mean, we all have it. Everyone torques a bow their own natural way, however it may be. You have your shooting style, call it whatever you want, but that's what it does. And
it does those too. It does up,
right,
and down.
So you can, yes, see,
if your anchor points off, up and down. So that's the other thing I always liked about it. And it's not that I rely on it, because I half the time I'm not even paying attention to it, you know, in my normal shooting, whatever. But
I can definitely see where that's helpful.
I always glance up at it real quick. And the very first time I noticed it was, I had a buck underneath my stand that was stand hunting for whitetail. And I must have been cranking that bow over, because I couldn't even see the dot. Like, that's because I was so amped up about this buck that I was just ripping on it, you know? And then ever since that, I was like, I never went away from that sight, even though it's not, you know, it's not the greatest sight. Like, there's so many, like, CBE makes way better sights, and AccuTouch and all these other, you know, sights that make much more precision, you know, stuff. But because of that, I keep staying with it, because that little... Anyway,
yeah, there's something you should check out called and maybe you have, I don't know, but it's Sweet Spot Pro. Guy named Donnie Thacker, he come out with this a couple of years ago, and basically what it is, it's a strain gauge that goes on your bow, and you have to glue it on there, but what it does is it measures the amount of pressure that you're putting on the bow. Okay. And measures it so accurately that, I mean, I've played with it a ton, and what it's there for is to see if you're constantly pulling on the bow the exact same every time. And you can set the sweet spot, basically, you know, the range on it. If you want to set it down to where it's just a few numbers, you know, between each other, where it's super tight, and I mean, you have to be crazy, crazy accurate, you can get it set like that. Or you can set it where it's got a much wider range, top to bottom, and how you use it. You use this with any site. And it doesn't matter if it's CBE or, you know, whoever site. It's a little box basically that you.
I think I've seen something like that.
You strap it to the site, and it's also it can be used as a light. But basically it goes in the, like I have a scope housing, and I have, you know, for hunting, I have a scope housing too. And it's got, I don't use a lens or anything in it, but I have 5 pins in my scope housing, and you could set it up to where the light actually goes to your pins if you wanted. And so, you know, when you're in the sweet spot by the color of the light, for instance, like when it's good, it's on green. Uh-huh. And when it's not good, you're on red.
Okay.
So it's pretty cool. When you started talking about that, you know, talking about, you know, where you're at in relationship to your anchor and your torque load, that's the next thing. Am I pulling the same? Because when you said, you know, I was wrenching the crap out of that sucker, you know, it's just, that just makes me think of that, you know, because you can be accurate with the amount of pull that you put on your shot. And this thing has all kinds of little details to it. It goes back to, like, you can, you know, you can check it out. Like I said, check that out. Sweet Spot Archery. I think, I don't even, to be honest with you, I don't even know what his, website is or anything, but it's pretty cool. Like I said, Sweet Spot Archery, I'm sure you'll find it. Lancaster Archery has them in stock. I know they sell them. Pretty cool stuff. It's a good trainer.
I'll check it out. So lastly, if you got time, if you could share with us a story, about when you were faced with extreme angle, or if even if it's not even extreme angle hunting, but or if you want to share with us a story where you learned something about archery that, you know, changed the way you hunt, either way is fine with me.
Well, you know, I guess there's probably all kinds of stories that I could say that, you know, basically about every time I go out, I learn something that changes the way I hunt almost, just for the simple fact that I'm constantly learning new stuff all the time. But as far as the angles go, this year, I mean, I've been hunting a long time, but this was actually my very first year to go elk hunting. I've always been in the archery business. So like a farmer at harvest time, if you're in the archery business, August and September is going to be your busiest 2 months. And so I've never been able to get away from work during that time, just for the simple fact that, you know, fields are ripe and we're harvesting basically. Right. And so this year was the first opportunity that I felt comfortable about going out west and doing some hunting. So I was getting, and this kind of has the extreme angle idea, what I may have learned. There is no way that I've found here at home to get ready for the elevation that changes everything out there. So, you know, you can run with a mask on or whatever on the treadmill to help you get better at all that sort of stuff. But when you run up to the top of one of those mountains and you're looking down, the extreme angle that's involved and the extreme thin air, I would like to spend a lot more time out there to try and figure out a whole lot more of that out, just because it did kick my butt for a few days. And I knew it was going to, but we had such a great time, and I didn't actually ever get to loose an arrow, but I definitely learned a lot about those angles and what I can expect next time when I go hunting, because I don't have anything here that I can practice those kind of angles at that distance very much. Now, I live in what they call the Ozark Mountains.
Uh-huh.
And they must have been Lewis and Clark naming these mountain ranges, because they come from the east, right? And they went west. They had already been in the mountain ranges in, you know, like the Appalachians, so they knew that. And when they got here, they thought, oh, well, these are pretty much mountains. And then when they got further west, they had to have thought, well, we screwed up. Those really weren't mountains that we were crossing earlier. Because the Ozark Mountains aren't really mountains, per se. But we do have a lot of steep inclines for a long... I mean, we have every bit as steep incline as what is out west. It just doesn't go up to 12,000 feet. You know, it just it stops here pretty short. 2,000, 3,000, that sort of thing. So so I can shoot those angles, but I have to really work hard to find a place to do it. And so that's what I'm going to do, hopefully, in preparation for next year, is I'm going to spend a little bit more. I already got an area in mind because I've turkey hunted it a whole bunch in the past, and it is really steep. But I'm going to have to go cut some shooting lanes, which could be a bigger challenge since it's on national forest. I don't know that I'm actually supposed to do that. So I'm going to have to find some of the deadfall areas and make it happen. But I know that really isn't much of a, it changed my angles or, you know, changed how I shoot angles, but, that's definitely going to change where I practice shooting my angles.
There you go. Where'd you go, elk hunting, buds?
Out in Idaho.
Idaho? Oh, yeah. See, yeah. Idaho is kind of a tough place for, you know, first-time elk hunting.
I really learned a ton. And really, the mountains, it was everything I expected it to be. I won't say that, like I said earlier when I said it kicked my butt, I was totally expecting to get my butt kicked for a couple of days.
Right.
And I knew I would get adjusted to it. And I finally did, got what I think was well adjusted to it. And then my biggest issue that I ran into was when we finally got on elk, we were so far back. I got on one of 9.8 miles from the truck. And I know that's, you know, that's a straight line from what Onyx said.
Right.
So it's obviously a lot longer hiking, but I was trying to find an outfitter or someone around that would
pack it out.
They'd pack me out if I actually got one, and I run into just huge problems of finding that because, you know, they need to be licensed and everything out in Idaho in order to actually do that. And when I got home 2 weeks later, I got in touch with one. So it was kind of frustrating because I got on a bull that was pretty hot and heavy, and it was one of the most heart wrenching feelings, thinking, okay, I'm way back here. I don't think I can get him out before he spools, because it wasn't getting super cold, and I had to pass. I had to go on somewhere else, and it was not a good feeling. But yet it was a good feeling, you know, being out there and chasing them and actually getting on one and the opportunity was cool. I wish I'd have actually chased him and just videoed just for the heck of it, you know, to show everybody here's what I was after. But honestly, my heart was sinking so deep at that point. I just wanted to get out of there. It's like, oh, man, I can't even kill this thing. Out here, and this is what I come for, and got to go somewhere else, that sort of thing. And I feel like I made the right decision at the time, and maybe overall it was the right decision. I really don't know, but I have to think it was. I learned a lot. I didn't get myself in a jam, and I definitely didn't shoot an animal that I couldn't pack out. So
that's awesome. I mean, I can't say that I would have did the same thing because I'm very. When I'm in the heat of the moment, I don't know if I err to the side of being conservative at times, but you definitely did the right thing. I mean, that's a really hard thing to do, to work that hard to make an opportunity and then have to head pass because, you know, the situation isn't right.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, awesome, man. Thank you for letting me chew your ear off over here for the last couple hours. And you know, if you want to come, if you put in for Arizona and you get drawn, let me know.
Yeah, I should have been doing that for years, but I haven't been doing that, so I need to get after that. Actually, I think I've just about talked myself into putting on the bucket list January mule deer hunt out there. One of the biggest problems I have with January is we kick off shooting competition, and it's just so hard because almost every weekend there's some place to go shoot, or if there's not something to a place to go shoot, then you know, you've got the trade show and all that sort of stuff that goes on, and it's just so much in January. It's really hard to get away, but that might be something I do in the near future. I don't know.
Javelina hunting in February.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
It's basically the same terrain, the same spot stock on a less formidable prey, but it's, the javies are a lot easier to get close to than deer, but
yeah,
but it's still the same experience. So it's kind of a way to get your feet wet.
Yeah, that would be good.
So, yeah. All right, man. Well, thanks a lot, and we'll talk to you soon. It was nice having you on.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Enjoyed it.
All right. Take it easy.
Thanks.
Hey, guys, if you're looking for a really good hunt, every year, my outfitting service, Days in the Wild, we take out a handful of clients for deer and javelina in the archery season and rifle seasons here. It's too late to get a rifle tag now for deer, but the draw is opening for javelina, and if you want to get a rifle tag for javelina, or you'd like to come out and do a combination archery javelina hunt, archery deer and javelina hunt, give me a shout. Hit me up on Instagram or Facebook, or hit me up on the blog, or go to our website, daysinthewild.com, and contact us through there. We can talk about it and build you your hunt of your, I don't know, I want to say of your dreams, but definitely an awesome time and lots of action and really true Western experience where you're getting to do a lot of spot and stalk, getting to navigate the mountains. It's a good time. Great weather that time of year. Most of our hunts take place in December and January for the deer and javelina combination. And if you're coming just for javelina, those are typically in February. So give us a shout, and we'll put together a great hunt for you. Thanks.